pocket, jusqu'à pocket, long pop. Jusqu'à pocket, jusqu'à pocket, long pop, pop, pop. Jusqu'à pocket, jusqu'à pocket, long pop, pop, pop. Om ni närmar er igen så ska jag jaga er till baka. De är som järva bara, äter på med deras mat. Och citat, de kommer hungriga i våben och giriga, och tills de nästan lägger på med ställa fucker så vi får skriva storyn om en aktivist, artist eller giss provocerande. Hon var en samhällsterrorist eller var hon mexikan? Var det fjällen eller stan eller uppkäftig dima? Hon bara shit, hon har barn. Men du ska backa långt bak. Om du närmar er igen så ska jag jaga er tillbaka. Aldrig gjort ett shit som jag vill ta tillbaka. Citaten som jag har droppat alltid och spik rak alltså. Du ska backa långt bak. Du ska backa långt bak, bak, bak. Du ska backa långt bak, bak, bak. Om du närmar er igen så ska jag jaga er tillbaka. Jag ska övertala dig att du kan bli vad du vill. Jag kommer alltid stötta dig, alltid hålla dig i handen, alltid ställa upp för dig. De andra trakasserar men jag slåss för dig. Så när de kommer som en flock rätt emot mig ska jag samla flera. Sen bara boom, attackera, underskatta alla när en katt tycker stå och göra ra. Jag är galen, står i fronten så bara acceptera. Att om de rör mina brudar igen ska jag hämta mina varor. Jag ska jaga dig till branten. Jag var den där som aldrig visar sympati. Så den som fuckar mina brudar ska jag jaga över kanten. Så hugg i som agerar ra, 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 ra. Hugg i som agerar ra, ra, ra. Hugg i som agerar ra, 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 ra. Ra, 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 ra. Hugg i som agerar ra, 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 ra. Hugg i som agerar ra, ra, ra. Hugg i som agerar ra, 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 ra. Ra, 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 ra. Så jävla het. Du fucking brinner om du nuddar mig. Så big bam boom exploderar jag framför dig. Backa långt bak så du inte pissar ner dig. Fastlåsta hundar lyder under jantelagen. Svika sidan bak för fucking blodad tann och smaken. Acceptera att du har redan blivit slagen. Utan Zappes terrorist för jag ska skriva om lagen. Hey! Så du ska backa långt bak. Du ska backa långt bak, bak, bak. Du ska backa långt bak, bak, bak. Om du närmar dig igen så ska jag jaga dig tillbaka.
Tervetuloa Totuusradion pariin. Minä olen Pieta Hyvärinen ja tämänpäiväinen lähetys He ovat tehneet vuorista litteitä kertoo kolonialismin jäljistä alkuperäisväestön elämässä. Äskeisen kappaleen Bakkabak esitti saamelaisartisti ja aktivisti Maksida Määrak Jokmokista Pohjois-Ruotsista. Lähetys koostuu kahden alkuperäiskansa aktiivin ja tutkijan puheista, jotka he pitivät maaliskuun lopulla Tukholmassa järjestetyssä poliittisen ekologian Undisciplined Environments-konferenssissa. Molemmat puhujat ovat kotoisin Amerikan mantereelta, toinen pohjoisesta ja toinen etelästä. Kim Tolberg kuuluu Dakota-alkuperäisväkeen, joka elää Etelä-Dakotan osavaltion alueella Yhdysvalloissa. Hän työskentelee apulaisprofessorina Albertan yliopistossa Kanadassa alkuperäiskansatutkimuksen laitoksella. Tolberg käsittelee kolonisaation vaikutusta alkuperäisväen perhesuhteisiin, suhteeseen maahan ja omistamiseen. Lisäksi hän puhuu ei-inhimillisestä luonnosta suhteuttaen uusmateriaalistista teoriaa alkuperäisväestön tietämisen tapoihin. Hän tarkastelee myös feminististä liikehdintää alkuperäisväen keskuudessa. Toinen puhuja Alton Krenak puolestaan kuuluu Krenaki-heimoon, joka asuu Minas Geraisin osavaltion alueella Dosajoen varrella itäisessä Brasiliassa. Krenak puhuu kolonisaation vaikutuksista alueisiin, joilla alkuperäisväki elää, sekä kolonisaation purkamisen välttämättömyydestä. Lisäksi hän kertoo Brasilian suurimmasta ympäristöonnettomuudesta, joka tapahtui syksyllä 2015, kun BHC Billingtonin ja Vale-yhtiön omistaman Samarcon kaivoksen jätepato murtui ja tuhosi 600 kilometriä Doce-joesta. Lopuksi kuulemme Ailton Krenakin myös laulavan sekä kritisoivan voimakkaasti länsimaista valtioiden ylläpitämää koulutusjärjestelmää. Krenak puhuu portugaliksi ja puheen suomeksi tulkkaa Aura Kalli. Vaikka molemmat puhujat tulevat maapallon toiselta puolelta, kolonisaation vaikutukset näkyvät ja tuntuvat paljon lähempänäkin. Saamelaiset Suomen, Ruotsin, Norjan ja Venäjän alueella kamppailevat samankaltaisten itsemäärittelyn, autonomiaan ja alueiden käyttöön liittyvien kysymysten parissa. Vajaa 10 vuotta sitten alkanut kaivosbuumi sekä esimerkiksi tänä vuonna muutettu metsähallituslaki Suomessa ovat kaventaneet saamelaisten itsemääräämisoikeuksia omilla alueillaan. Nyt päästämme Kim Tolbergin ääneen. Puhe on englanniksi. Tolbergin puheen lomassa kuullaan 2 kappaletta, jotka on omistettu alkuperäisväestön Idle No More -liikkeelle. No More, jonka esittää Ojibwe-kansaan kuuluva artisti Plex, featuring Lace, sekä The Road, Powwow-musiikkia hip-hopiin ja dubstepiin yhdistelevältä Tribe Called Red -kokoonpanolta.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks for coming out. Such a big, nice crowd. I speak fast, even for Americans, so I've been told to try to slow down. It's so hard for me, but I'll try. So this talk, Disrupting Settlement, Sex and Nature, and Indigenous Logic of Relationality, you're going to be thinking with me today as I give this talk, because I'm working towards a book that's tentatively titled that. So I've been working with this material for a couple of years, but some of it's relatively new, and I've got different streams of research that seem wildly different that are coming together, particularly the research I do on monogamy, against marriage, non-monogamy, and then other forms of settler colonialism that involve the partitioning of land and environmental degradation. But you can't deconstruct nature without deconstructing sex, right? They're very similar types of objects. So I analyze entangled sets of rigid and hierarchical Euro-American settler relations imposed as state policy and national culture in the U.S. and Canada. We use the term settler a lot in Canada. It's indigenous people versus settlers, right? And there is a politics of that as well. So hierarchies among humans and non-humans are intimately related to hierarchies and categorizations within human relations. These two co-constitute one another. Settler management of land in North America has always been intimately related to settler management of women, children, Indians, slaves, non-human animals, bodies as well. So I begin this talk by critiquing hetero and homonormative, couple-centric, monogamous marriage or such forms of romantic love more broadly, but bear with me, political ecology-minded people, because I will segue into a critique of life versus not life binaries, and also engage in a feminist indigenous reading of interspecies thinking and the new materialisms. So my overall impression is that settler relations, including both sexual relations and our relations with so-called nature, are not sustainable economically, emotionally, and materially for lots of persons, both indigenous and not, both human and not. And in my culture, we talk about non-human animals as persons too. So I'm going to begin with a creative vignette I've written. I do these 100-word vignettes, and it's a really nice generative writing practice. The vignette I'm going to read for you is called Sufficiency. And it was inspired by Thomas Prinzen's monograph, The Logic of Sufficiency, in which he explains the principle of sufficiency as being not about denial, not about sacrifice or doing without. But when resource depletion and overconsumption are real, sufficiency is about doing well. It's about good work and good governance. So I think through this logic of sufficiency also within the realm of loving human relations. So do we always need another love only for ourselves? And this includes children. Just like a village might better raise a child, so might a village better sustain individuals in loving relations. And you can read with me. This is a picture of a giveaway at a powwow, which I'm talking about in here. At a giveaway, we do them often at powwows, The family honors one of our own by thanking the people who jingle and shimmer in circle. They are with us. We give gifts in both generous show and as acts of faith in sufficiency. One does not future hoard. We may lament incomplete colonial conversions, our two little bank savings, the circle we hope will sustain. We sustain it. Not so strange, then, that I decline to hoard love and another's body for myself. I cannot have faith in scarcity. I have tried. It cut me from the circle. It was not always so that the monogamous couple ideal reigned. In Public Vows, A History of Marriage and Nation, Nancy Cott argues with respect to the U.S. that the Christian model of lifelong monogamous marriage was not a dominant worldview until the 19th century, and it took work to make monogamous marriage seem like a foregone conclusion, and that people had to choose to make marriage the foundation for the new nation. In The Importance of Being Monogamous, Sarah Carter also shows how marriage was part of the national agenda in Canada. The marriage fortress was established to guard the Canadian way of life. At the same time that monogamous marriage was solidified as ideal and central to both U.S. and Canadian nation building, Indigenous peoples in those two countries were being viciously restrained, both conceptually and physically inside colonial borders and institutions that included residential schools, churches, and missions. Also, urban relocation programs, these were all designed to save the man and kill the Indian. By cutting the Indian off from the collective, their peoples and tribes. Part of saving Indians from their savagery meant pursuing the righteous, monogamous, couple-centric nuclear family co-produced with private property, including the partitioning of the tribal land base into individually owned allotments held under men's names. Cree Métis feminist Kim Anderson writes, "One of the biggest targets of colonialism was the Indigenous family, in which women had occupied positions of authority and controlled property. The colonial state targeted women's power. It tied land tenure rights to heterosexual, one-on-one, lifelong monogamous marriage, thus tying women's economic well-being to men who controlled the property. Indeed, women became property." 150 years after my Dakota ancestors were brought under colonial control, the unsustainable nuclear family is the most commonly idealized alternative to the tribal and extended family context in which I was raised. Prior to colonization, the fundamental social unit of my people was the extended kin group, including plural marriage. The Dakota word for extended family is teoshpaye. The word for tribe or people is oyate. It sometimes gets mistranslated into nation. You can see that 19th century civilizing project in that. So my road to studying ethical non-monogamy began early in my observations in tribal communities of mostly failed monogamy, extreme serial monogamy, and disruptions to nuclear family. Throughout my growing up, I was subjected by both whites and natives ourselves to narratives of shortcoming and failure. Descriptions of Native American broken families, teenage pregnancies, unmarried mothers, and other failed attempts to paint a white, nationalist, middle-class veneer over our lives. I used to think it was the failures to live up to that ideal that turned me off domesticity. And that's why I ran for coastal cities and higher education. Why I asserted from a very early age that I would never get married. Now I see that it was not my family's so-called failures, but rather I was suffocating under the weight of the aspirational ideal of a normative middle-class nuclear family, including heterosexual coupledom, period. I was a happy child in those moments when I sat at my great-grandmother's dining room table with four generations and later in her life, five generations. We would gather in her small dining room, people overflowing into the equally small living room. All the generations would eat and laugh, play cards, drink coffee, talk tribal politics, and eat again. The children would run in and out. Couples and marriages and nuclear family got little play there. The matriarch of our family, my great-grandmother, was always laughing. She would tell funny, poignant stories about our family, about other families and individuals, both natives and whites, in our small town throughout the 20th century. Aunts and uncles would contribute their childhood memories to build on her stories. My mom would always bring the conversation back to national or tribal politics. A great-grandchild would be recognized from some new accomplishment. The newest baby would be doted upon as a human who had chosen our family, that's our belief. And the mom who might be 18 and unmarried would have help, as Kim Anderson explains. Our traditional societies had been sustained by strong kin relations in which women had significant authority. There was no such thing as a single mother, because Native women and their children lived and worked in extended kin networks. Despite colonial violence against our kin systems, we are, in everyday practice, still adept at extended family. Beyond biological family, we create institutions that function as a teoshpaye. So, for example, the survival school movement, this is a picture here, unfolded in St. Paul in Minneapolis, Minnesota in the 1970s as part of a community response within the American Indian movement to racism in our public schools. Each day would open and close with a ceremony. Academics were combined with indigenous culture. It was Anishinaabe in that case. And everyone got fed, which for poor children was key. We also have ceremonies to adopt kin. And in my extended family, we engage in a lot of legal adoption, which is aided by a piece of legislation, the Indian Child Welfare Act, that prioritizes now the adoption of Native children into other tribal families so they can maintain their culture. That's a direct response to the kidnapping of our children throughout the late 19th and early 20th century by churches and federal government. So our tribal webs of kinship share with ethical non-monogamy when it goes beyond individual discourses of freedom and self-actualization to make family and community the possibility for greater emotional, environmental, and economic sustainability.
But what's happening with the Indians? I mean, what are they doing for them, you know? Don't they legally really own the land?
Not enough.
Well, they've made so much money out of the Indians. At first they took the land, and then they made movies about them taking the land, you know? It's a bit mean, you know? But we always used to stick up for the Indians in Britain on the movies, you know?
How many
people think there's only a few Indians left. There's millions of them in the whole continent of America, which includes South America. And one day they're going to be asking for their rights. I wouldn't be surprised if they weren't standing next to the black people, too. So it's either give now or die later, I reckon.
Say it loud, we native and proud, we're waiting it out. The best day to be native is now. It is what it gotta be, hurt the economy. Whatever it takes to get the PM in front of me. Government's still the real fucking terrorists. Ever since they came to the Americas. Bringing guns to a peaceful protest. Target the hopeless, weak and oppressed. They all cannibals, filthy animals. And if you figure that's cool, it's understandable. Try to walk a block in my shoes and talk to the cop with the Glock behind you. They all cowards, hungry for power. Ain't satisfied till the land's been devoured. Vampires, they out for blood. They chop trees and they run pipe right through the mud. They say we drill oil cause we need it. They figure we're sheep, we'll believe it. They treat treaties like shit, we're mistreated. We only want what's ours and that's freedom. Freedom. See us dead or in prison, and 39% of Canadians are with them. The sign of the times is like, who do you trust? They want the whole fucking pie, won't even save me the crust. Offering us crumbs is some sort of favor to us. They control the terms and we're made to adjust, but we can fight back. Let's see how they like that. After these messages, we'll be right back. When we return, we crash and burn and rise from the ashes. And what did we learn? Huh? Shit's the same, ain't a damn thing changed. 500 years of shit and we're all the remains. America's history is written in blood, and all the government does is sweep it under the rug.
So now I want to talk about caretaking other than human relations and indigenizing interspecies thinking. taking that extended family metaphor out beyond humans now. So I want to link this particular biopolitical topic, the managing of intimate human relations entangled with land and property through monogamous marriage, to other academic conversations that similarly need to be informed, I think, by indigenous standpoints. I want to talk about non-humans now and how indigenous thought accords greater animacy to non-humans, including non-organisms such as stone and place. We've recently seen an upsurge of scholarship in the field of animal studies in which social science and humanities scholars attempt to recover knowledge territory claimed for several centuries by the natural sciences and to lessen hierarchies between, quote, Westerners and their non-human others. A good example of this is multi-species ethnography, in which scholars apply anthropological approaches to studying social relations between humans and non-humans. New anthropological accounts are starting to appear in which non-humans previously relegated to the status of bare life or that which is killable are now considered alongside humans in the realm of bios, with legibly biographical and political lives. This is multi-species ethnography, and it shows how organisms, so for example, animals, plants, fungi, microbes, shape and are shaped by political, economic, and cultural forces. New work in critical animal studies articulates with Dorian Sagan's work on interspecies communities and in his critique of two linear evolutionary narratives. Sagan is a science writer. He's the son of astronomer Carl Sagan and biologist Lynn Margulis. He seeks to dismantle hierarchies in the relationships of Westerners to their non-human others. In speaking of symbiogenesis and the importance of microbes in constituting humans, Sagan explains, you can read along, "We are crisscrossed and cohabited by stranger beings, intimate visitors who affect our behavior, appreciate our warmth, and are in no rush to leave. Like all visible life forms, we humans are composites." This account of symbiogenesis seems to lean towards an ethos of we are all related. I read in Sagan that we are, all of us, human and non-human, network sets of social, biological relations. He calls such human-non-human networks interspecies communities, which resonates with what Vine Deloria Jr. called an American Indian metaphysic. For those of you who don't know Vine Deloria Jr., he's probably the most well-known 20th century Native American intellectual from the United States. So Deloria's American Indian metaphysic is a set of first principles we must possess in order to make sense of the world in which we live. In his essay of the same title, Deloria wrote that the best description of the term is the realization that the world and all its possible experiences constituted a social reality, a fabric of life in which everything had the possibility of intimate, knowing relationships, because ultimately everything was related. Yet Deloria and Sagan's understanding of intimate human-non-human relations are not in complete harmony. In the opening of his 2010 American Anthropological Association keynote, "The Human is More Than Human," Sagan turned his attention to life, and he opened that talk. "It is to this universe that I want to turn again, and to a specific part of it. I want to turn to life, and within that part, a fascinating subsystem, the one in which, of course, we are most interested, that is humanity ourselves." For Sagan, life is limited to things that are organismically defined. This tends to be true as well of social scientists and humanists who engage in animal studies, not only biophysical scientists. Multi and interspecies conversations restrict attention to beings that live according to a definition that cannot completely contain indigenous standpoints. So this is an example of an American Indian metaphysic in action. This is Wing Springs, the name of the site here in South Dakota near where I'm from. So in an American Indian metaphysic, as Deloria describes it, the notion of interspecies must be stretched to include non-human others that are not understood always, even in critical Western frameworks, as living. So this is an example of the knowledge production of my colleague, Craig Howe. He's an Oglala Lakota architect. He's also trained as an anthropologist, and he's a Lakota studies expert. He left the mainstream academy to found a research center in South Dakota, which he built on his family's land, and these pictures are from that. This is between the Pine Ridge and Rosebud Indian Reservations in South Dakota, if you're familiar with that geography. So in addition to running Lakota Studies workshops at the facility, Craig lives there in daily contact with a host of non-humans on the land, and he documents those relations weekly in his blog, Oko Iya Wapi, or Week Count. So he engages with rabbits, and there's a picture of a rabbit. When he works outside, they alternately take afternoon naps in the shade of his structures. Sometimes they thwart his architectural projects with their own adamant digging. He also studies the lodges of spiders, which are akin to teepees in their form. He follows the movements of what he calls star people in relation to the distant buttes as he plots and builds the structures of his facility. One could see Craig Howe as studying rabbits, spiders, and the cosmos. These entities are less animate than his human self, but such hierarchy is not found in Craig's words and photographs. In his blog, he documents his consistent relations, as he calls it, with non-humans, including some currently excluded in animal studies, and the ways in which they do work in the world and help constitute the land and the buildings along with him. So being an anthropologist, he could construct all of this as studying, but he really doesn't. He does a good job of representing these as social relations. So I want to turn after that then to think about the new materialisms. So it's a second academic conversation after interspecies relations in which I think indigenous thinkers need to be included, because the new materialist thinkers are moving beyond interspecies or multi-species ethnographies, right, to think about the agency of things we can't call living. But again, the new materialisms cannot completely contain indigenous standpoints, even though I think it's beginning to get there. And this is why I think indigenous theorists need to weigh in on these academic conversations. So work in the new materialisms seeks to extend our understanding of how non-human lives press into and are co-constituted with human lives, and therefore how these non-living things are agentic in our world. In New Materialism's Ontology, Agency, and Politics, Kuhl and Frost explain the project. This is here. Finally, we are summoning a new materialism in response to a sense that the radicalism of the dominant discourses which have flourished under the cultural turn is now more or less exhausted. We share the feeling current among many researchers that the dominant constructivist orientation to social analysis is inadequate for thinking about materiality and politics in ways that do justice to the contemporary context of biopolitics and global political economy. Jane Bennett in Vibrant Matter also calls for us to take seriously the vitality of things, meaning the capacity of things, edibles, commodities, storms, metals, not only to impede or block the will and designs of humans, but also to act as quasi-agents or forces with their own trajectories, etc. She also refers to this as an enchanted materialism. Why should we care about this? Like Kuhl and Frost, Bennett suggests that taking seriously the vitality of non-human, non-living things might shift our political responses to public problems. Bennett and other humanists, as well as social scientists, are reappraising the importance of materiality to human social and cultural life. The world is mediated heavily through culture, increasingly so in the Anthropocene, but the material is also productive, not simply dead, static, and acted upon. So the new materialists hold that to really grasp the nature of and potential solutions to the world's most critical problems, environmental degradation, climate change, poverty, etc., non-humans in all their myriad forms must be given their due. We also have Mel Chen, who wrote in Animacies along similar lines. After an extended illness and forced to rethink the boundary between life and death, Chen interrogates a fragile division between animate and inanimate. Chen disrupts the stubborn binaries of life, death, human, animal, dynamism, stasis, subject, object that underlie violent hierarchies in our world, and invokes the language of animacy in place of life or liveliness, which while I'm more comfortable using the term life in a more expansive than biological meaning, Chen would understand it probably more strictly in biological terms, but we're in conversation because, again, Chen, I think, is taking on notions of race and ways in which the new materialisms don't often do that quite so extensively. But still, Chen is also looking for a secular language. and this is not something that I really have to do from an indigenous standpoint, we can sort of take up the concept of life force or spirit, while that's inadequate language when we're talking about the animacy of non-living things. So again, these conversations are getting closer to being in conversation with an indigenous point of view, but they're not quite all the way there. So I want to bring in a couple of other thinkers too then to help us get farther along on this road. So what's not new about the new materialisms? An indigenous metaphysic again, which is a network set of social material relations. So again, as an indigenous person, I'm comfortable enfolding spirits or souls into descriptions of the beingness of non-humans. And this is a quote from Charles Eastman. So this is an old school thinker, but he's doing some interesting things. He wrote in 1911, and this language is inflected with Christianity, but I still think there's something there from a Dakota point of view about the what you might call the animacy of non-living things. And he says that the elements and majestic forces in nature, lightning, wind, water, fire, and frost, were regarded with awe as spiritual powers. We believe that the spirit pervades all creation and that every creature possesses a soul in some degree, though not necessarily a soul conscious of itself. The tree, the waterfall, the grizzly bear, each is an embodied force and as such an object of reverence. Again, though, keeping in mind the difficulties of translating into English and looking at a lot of this older work and going back in time, I've realized how seriously inflected English in the United States and Canada is, at least with Christianity, and it's really hard to translate indigenous words and ideas into English without so inflecting it. So Charles Eastman was born into a quote-unquote Indian world, but at that moment when Native people were being dispossessed from their traditional lands in what is today Minnesota, some were killed, others were imprisoned after a war that took place in 1862. At this point, Eastman converted to Christianity, and he trained in Boston as a medical doctor. So in the early 20th century, he was writing of American Indian life and history for an educated Christian audience, to a liberal American audience, and that in part is why I think he's writing like that. So both Eastman and Vine Deloria Jr. can be understood within a framework that posits social relations not only between animals, but also with energy, spirits, rocks, and stars, and the constitution of indigenous knowledge about the world. Again, Vine Deloria Jr. calls this an American Indian metaphysic. I'll call it an indigenous metaphysic. That is an understanding of the intimate, knowing, relatedness of all things. So as I refer to them, our co-constitutive entanglements between the material and the immaterial, indigenous people's social relations with spirit beings, for lack of a better term, described by Eastman and Deloria, constitute a boundary crossing that's difficult for interspecies and new materialist thinkers. So that's partly what they're leaving out, right? We also have social relations with beings who move among us, but without bodies. We would call those spirits in English. But I'm not sure that's quite right, because again, it's so inflected with Christianity and the hierarchies that brings into any conversation, which I don't think that we really have. So Eastman and Deloria on the previous slide get classed as Native American intellectuals, which is the pertinent 20th century racial category, but they were in fact both Dakota, they come from my people, and I use them not just because I'm ethnocentric, but their work actually constitutes a prominent literature in academic English that allows me to think about these things. But it would be really exciting to see other indigenous thinkers begin entering these conversations with adding to the conversations with other forms of indigenous thought. And so on that note, I'll just call attention quickly to the work of David Shorter on the bottom. He's at UCLA, and he's a scholar of UMA, indigenous thought. He provides us a language beyond the spiritual for capturing the kinds of interspecies, maybe cross beings is a more inclusive term, forms of relating that indigenous peoples have engaged in. He's critical of the term spirituality, and I'll just read a bit of this. Critical analyses of the oral stories and earliest ethnographic accounts continue to reveal that rather than being spiritual, quote unquote, Native people were relating. Less cumbersome than intersubjective, related might best replace spiritual, since it neither denies possible theisms or hierarchies. One's relations are not solely related by blood or tribal heritage. That's what we're talking about when we're talking about these network sets of social biological relations between humans and non-humans, including those beings we call spirits. So again, just to emphasize the point, I think indigenous thinkers have really important contributions to make to these academic conversations, and not just because we're interested in remaking the Academy or making it more inclusive. But I think for me, it's about participating in conversations with thinkers who we have a hope of doing some translation work with, because that helps us actually gather up resources to go back and build our own institutions. So I'm actually sort of a person who believes in reverse colonization. I want to come in as an Indigenous person to the colonial edifice that is this and get resources and pull them back out and go home and build institutions at home and our own capacity to govern. So that's partly why I'm interested in this. It's also that I'm an Indigenous intellectual and this stuff is interesting, but it's also a sort of an activist project as well. So I'm going to turn to talk about life in the form of a stone now. So for those of you that don't know my work, I spent the last 15 years, or until this book was written, Native American DNA, thinking about life in the form of blood and DNA, and looking at the work of that genetic researchers do on Native American bodies and human migrations and genetic ancestry. So it surprised me when I got to Pipestone that I was still looking at blood, but now in a symbolic form. And so it's the conceptual territory is not that far from DNA. So what I'm looking at now is the way that we conceive of life in that particular stone. And that stone is harvested from the Pipestone quarries in southwest Minnesota. I was born in this town. It's a really important cultural center. It's about 15 miles from the reservation where I grew up. And we talk about this stone. This is a creation story, which I won't read. It's a flood story, where one young woman or a girl survives, and then from her come the people. So I don't know to what degree, again, this is influenced by other kinds of creation stories. But the idea is that when the people died during this great flood, all their blood pooled down in the low ground, and this blood-red stone came from that. That stone is very important to us because it's used to make ceremonial pipes, and that's a picture of a pipe up there. So, like scientists in earlier centuries with their imperative to bleed indigenous peoples before it was too late, a 19th century Euro-American painter and early 20th century geologists and government agents saw this place where the red stone lies as an artifact of a waning culture and time. They made a national monument to conserve the site, and the binaries at play in this site are very similar to the binaries at play in Native American DNA research, and that's thinking about Native people in terms of the past, not the present, as traditional, not modern, as dead or dying rather than alive. And so this narrative of death and dying really kind of conditions the desire of the Park Service to keep quarriers and carvers working in these quote-unquote traditional ways with sort of primitive tools. This is Travis Erickson. I just love this picture of him smoking while he's quarrying stone. This is me hauling dirt for him because I got no skill and all I can do is haul dirt and gravel. But he tells me a lot of stuff when I'm working hard. So, so I found in working on this site that just like with Native Americans who want to continuing, say, in Native American DNA research, that the people around this site as well want a continuing say in how the site is run. So there's currently a big debate going on. And I'm thinking about all of the people, both Native and non-Native, who are in relation to this place as sets of relations. And so this book is going to be called Pipestone Relations. And this is where all of this theory is coming together. So I'm thinking about the stone as a being that has agency, if you will, that is cohering all of these humans around it. So you've got people like Travis Erickson, who is a fifth-generation quarrier and carver, working at Pipestone, lived there his whole life, who's got intimate knowledge of the way that Pipestone lies under granite and the glaciers that brought these stones down, and the way that he's got a lot of skill about how you get through granite, the second hardest stone in the world, to get to Pipestone, one of the softest, without breaking the Pipestone. His knowledge about that land comes both from being an intimate, lifelong relationship with it, but also from talking to scientists who are really interested in the geology and the sort of ecology of that place. So then you've got the scientists who I view as in relation with this place, right, constituting knowledge about it, being out there in intimate relation on the land. You've got government bureaucrats who are managing the place with a kind of an interesting set of moral obligations. You've got local non-Native people who are really interested in the tourism value that the quarries bring to their town. But they've also got a historical sense of wanting to, in a liberal sense, do the right thing in relationship to this place. So again, I can bring in sort of new materialisms theory, interspecies thinking. I can bring in cultural notions from my own Dakota background about how we are all related in order to constitute all of these humans and non-humans as being an intimate relation in this place. And I'm telling all of this from a Dakota standpoint as well. One of the things that I like to do in my work is to turn the gaze back around. Usually it's white people or Euro-American or European people who are looking at us as objects of study, right? But for me, there's a bit of performance in that. I like to look at all of you as objects of study because I think you are very curious cultural beings, and particularly curious in a Euro-American intellectual framework to me are scientists. They are very, very interesting. So I spend a lot of time studying them in minute ways. But I also become friends with them, right? I haven't quite gone Native, but you do become friends. So I want to come back to Indigenous feminism. So you're getting like a circuitous view through this next book, but hopefully after feedback from you and others, it'll be a little bit more streamlined. So I want to turn back to the words of Indigenous feminists to link the obligations of human kin with our other than human kin. And I want to quote an Assiniboine scholar, Kate Shanley. She's not up here. She's a scholar from Montana. And she defines Indigenous feminism in a way that I think is commonly accepted amongst us Indigenous feminists. And I just gave a talk in Saskatoon and Saskatchewan in Canada, a whole Indigenous feminisms panel, and we had a room packed like this. I couldn't believe it to come hear about Indigenous feminism. So there's a lot going on right now in that area. But Kate Shanley says that Indigenous feminism seeks equality in two ways that do not concern mainstream women. I hope this is changing. Number one, on the individual level, the Native American woman struggles to promote the survival of a social structure whose organizational principles represent notions of family different than those of the mainstream. And number two, on the societal level, the people seek sovereignty as a people in order to maintain a vital legal and spiritual connection to the land, in order to survive as a people. So what she's saying is that women are at the center of caretaking relations that are about taking care of that relationship with non-humans, because we are co-constituted as peoples in particular places, as Indigenous peoples. So if we're not taking care of the land, if we're not maintaining those human and non-human relations, we can't continue to exist as a people. So I'm going to go back to the words of Kim Anderson again, and that's Kim up on top. Now, Kim writes about pregnancy, but we're gonna sit with that for a minute, and then I'm gonna turn that into something else. So she explains how pregnancy and the emotional intelligence of mothering are what really transformed her into an Indigenous feminist. She said pregnancy was a wake-up call about how far we have strayed from life-affirming principles in the mainstream and in Indigenous societies alike. And she links the deplorable conditions of many contemporary Native American women and children, I would add all kinds of other people to that, to colonization and its handmaiden patriarchy. And she says women were considered the head of the household because they were primarily responsible for the work involved in child rearing and managing the home. Empowered motherhood was not only a practice, but also an ideology that allowed women to assert their authority at various political levels. It was women, older women, who made the decisions and set the direction for all of the people, which they did as clan mothers, through women's councils, and as head women of their own extended families. So she analyzes the roles of women and what I would call governance at multiple levels. Her use of motherhood is attuned to how maternal roles are entangled in patriarchal policy and movements, but she advocates a form of mothering that I personally translate as caretaking, and which I see as detachable from the cisgendered, biologically reproductive woman's body. And I don't think Anderson would reserve mothering or caretaking for women alone either, for those recognized in dominant culture as the mother. For her, motherhood or caretaking is about working with other women and men in community organizations to advance Native women's health and well-being, which again always links back to the advancement of our people as a whole. So she's also done some recent work on Indigenous men and masculinities, and that's a cover from a recent book, which links Indigenous men's well-being to the advancement of Indigenous peoples broadly. And at a symposium in December in Alberta, she shared a story that was really illustrative about the sort of interesting caretaking roles that men can occupy. She talked about her father, who did all of the cooking for the family, and he always made children laugh. He had this goal to always have children laughing all the time around him. But she also talked about how he eventually drank himself to death. He was a survivor of the residential schools. And she did something in telling that story that I would argue Indigenous people do a lot to sustain ourselves in this era that some have dubbed the Anthropocene. And that is that we hold accounts of death and destruction in the wake of an apocalypse that our people have already endured for a century or more. So I think of us as post-apocalyptic peoples. We had perhaps 90% depopulation rates, many of us, right? So she holds that in one hand, and in the other hand, she tells these stories of life and recognition of our ongoing relationships with place. So in that story about her father, she both mourned and affirmed while she addressed masculinities in a way that was not only about men's well-being, but as with her work on women, also about caretaking the people. And that would go back in some of her other work to caretaking non-humans. So elsewhere, she has written that healthy life is maintained through balance between the various life forms, including men and women, and that caretaking promotes the health and well-being of the people and the environments they live in. So a key way to understand Indigenous feminism, as articulated by Anderson and by Idle No More, and that's the founders of Idle No More. How many of you in here have heard of Idle No More? Great, maybe about a quarter of you. Okay, Google it. 2 minutes, okay. Idle No More as well. These are four women. It's a settler woman on the left, Sheila McLean, and the other three are, I think they're Cree women. Founded Idle No More out of Canada, which has since turned into a global Indigenous women-led kind of environmental advocacy movement. And they're really about linking the relationships between Indigenous peoples and the Canadian state. They want to see an enforcement of Indigenous treaty rights, which have been repeatedly violated by the Canadian state, as they have been by the United States. And one of the things they say is that we need to enforce Indigenous treaty rights because that would help us protect the land from extractive resources. So that's not only good for Indigenous peoples, that's good for all Canadians, it's good for non-humans. And so, but it's really interesting that you see these women who have started this movement. And again, it's not only women, but it's women-led. And so I have really been thinking about that in relationship to what Kim Anderson says. This is down here, as you can't see it as well, but it's a little logo from Native Youth Sexual Health Network, or NISHN. And they are also a lot of young women and queer folks who are linking violations of the earth to violations of Indigenous and queer bodies. And they're also not only involved in environmental advocacy, but they're involved in sex worker rights as well, in the missing and murdered Indigenous women. So you can begin to see, this is kind of where I'm getting to, linking the violation of bodies in particular ways and the sort of cordoning off of land and the caging in of bodies and people into very kind of rigid kinds of relationships. So we have to think a lot about the way that the land is managed in these rigid hierarchical ways and the way that human beings are managed in these rigid hierarchical ways. So that's kind of where I'm going with this. And I just leave you with this blessing, I'll call it. May your networks of love and relations be many and not caged within settler colonial norms of rapacious individualism, hierarchies of life and ownership of land, bodies, and desires. And that's my office. Isn't that great? So thank you.
Son las 3 de la mañana. Dicen que pena un santeto. Bajito y oigo que dice:
camínale despacito, y mamá, camínale despacito.
Mi sueño me dice: no vaya. Mis piernas me dicen: tantito. Y cuando ya me doy cuenta, caramba, me muevo poco a poquito. Ay, mamá, me muevo poco a poquito.
Será tu zapata
si tú dices que me quieres,